Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Taproom Talks. This is the part two, if you will. This is the Q&A portion of the North Texas Beer Week panel that we did this past Monday. And all of the guys get to answer questions from a lot of our audience members that were there live. So, listen in.
Before we get started, just a couple of things we always like to run down.
Yeah. Some events coming up. We are smack dab in North Texas Beer Week, so we are going to be ending North Texas Beer Week here in our tap room on Sunday, November 20th, this Sunday, starting at 12 o'clock noon. Your Dallas Cowboys are playing the Baltimore Ravens. Your 8-1 rookie explosion Cowboys are going to be playing, and so to celebrate that, we are going to be doing a glass day in our tap room. It is the official armchair quarterbacks glass that we have made, and it has a really cool little football indention in the bottom of the glass. So come on out and get those. Those are going to be handed out by the glass. Keep the beer. We're doing that on Sunday. And then we have our holiday market coming up the following Saturday, November 26th. It is the Saturday after Thanksgiving.
Small Business Saturday.
Otherwise known as Small Business Saturday. We're going to have a lot of cool vendors out here, and they're going to be selling everything from like pickles and foods and toffee and jewelry and you name it. So come out, do some Christmas shopping, drink some beer, and get away from the malls. Yeah. and do that with us. And then we have our big one coming up.
Oh man.
A lot of y'all are waiting for it. And it goes by three little letters known as BBT. The BBT Day is going to be Saturday, December 10th. That's right. We are going to be doing it on Saturday, December 10th. We are going to kind of keep some of the details mum for right now, but just pencil in that date and then keep track on our events calendar, on our website, and on Facebook, and we will be sharing all of those lovely details with you very soon.
We promise we will let you know.
Yeah, but it's going to be good, so don't miss that.
So until then, enjoy the panel. So fair warning, we do have some audio weirdness. It was an outdoor panel. We did have a food truck. You know, wires got crossed.
They decided to leave a little early.
Yeah, so I'm going to do what I can to level out the sound. It's not bad. It just does not meet my standards of audio quality, so I am annoyed, but it does not actually affect your listening experience at all. If you hear anything else, just know we were outside in the beer garden. These things kind of will happen.
That's right. That's craft podcasting.
That's
that's what we do with craft podcasting.
That's what you
podcasting.
Love us for, warts right. and all.
That's right. So, enjoy.
It's a real difficult thing.
Well, one thing we do have here is very qualified beer drinkers here in our audience. So we're gonna take audience questions. So I'll come around and I'll try not to blow your eardrums out when I walk in front of the speaker. All right, who's got a question?
How y'all doing?
Good.
All right, so with all the expansion that you're seeing, do y'all see a shortage in any of the ingredients that you use to brew the beers?
Yes. It depends.
Am I the only one?
No.
It depends on what hops you want.
Yes.
And hops. Do you need some hops?
We're talking about hops.
Hey, I got some hops.
We're trying to get this.
Well, and there was a period a few years back where hops were very scarce. They would only sell them on contract, and it got to be the contracts were not fair to the brewers. They were,
expensive.
I can actually tell a story about that. I opened Franconia up right during the period where the hop shortage came in, and so I got the brewery everything ready, and now I'm starting getting supplies in. And there are pretty much two ways how you can buy hops. You can purchase it through contracts, or you can spot buy it. So for me, it didn't make sense at that point to enter in a hop contract because we started up at zero. I didn't know how much do we need, so I don't want to buy X amount of hops and then I don't need it. So I hit the brewery running, I got everything in. The only thing I couldn't get was hops. So I called around everywhere I could think and I could not get any hops. So, and luckily I had some good connections in Germany. One of my professors I learned from, his dad owns a big hop farm in the Hallertau in Germany. And I called him up and I said, you gotta help me out, I can't get hops over here. I mean, whatever you have, I don't even care at this point what it is. You got to send it to me.
You growing Citra over there?
let me give him a call tomorrow. And so he said, well, let me do this. Sending hops over, you know, it's a little bit tricky because you get your hop distributors in the United States. They have contracts with their hop farmers whatsoever. So he actually got me in contact with one of the, which I already called, one of the biggest hop distributors there is. And they already denied to send anything to me. And he said, well, give me 2 days. And then I got a phone call from there and said, what hops do you need and how much hops do you need? And at that point I said, well, whatever you have available, just send it to me, but what changed your mind? So what happened is this friend of mine, he had a container full of hops going to that hop distributor in the US, and he said, I do not release those containers to you until you took care of Franconia. So that was a good situation to be in. Now I think we're facing a little bit of different hop shortage. We're facing a hop shortage in specialty hops, in certain hops, because we just talked about it, the expansions and so many breweries, and you know, IPAs are still big out there, so we definitely run short on some of those, but I think it's definitely depend on what hop varieties you're using.
Jamie, did you say you had Citra?
I did. Yeah, no, I have quite a bit to add to this. I mean, I when I first started Community, I called up my hops contact at Yakima Chief, which is now Yakima Chief Hop Union. Oh, sorry, it was Hop Union, now it's Yakima Chief Hop Union. I'm like, hey, man, I want to get some Amarillo, some Simcoe, he laughs. He's like, Jamie, you can't get any of that stuff, man. I'm like, what do you got? And he's like, well, there's this experimental variety, HBC369. So it's a hop breeding council. They just give it a number. And this is 12 years in the making. Then they get it to brewers, and we decide if we like it or not. That ends up being the Mosaic hop. So by serendipity, call it what you will, that's how Mosaic was born. It's a blend of a lot of different hops, but it was really what I could get my hands on at the time. The funny thing now is, you know, I can't sleep. Our best-selling beer is Mosaic IPA, and I can't sleep. I would not be able to sleep if I didn't have hops to put in this beer. And people came up to me so frequently after we released Mosaic, and I was like, you're going to run out of Mosaic hops? You're going to run out? And I was never going to run out of these hops. And I never will, but I typically am over contracting hops just to be sure. It's planning on what you don't know. I don't have the crystal ball. So I have a lot of extra hops, so I'm getting rid of them, and I'm selling them at my contract prices. So when I contract hops, I can generally get them at a lower price. But what people are doing online is they're over contracting, and they're saying, I'm going to make $3 or $4 a pound on this. Well, I'm going, me and other brewers that are just, you know, I'm not trying to rip people off. I'm going in there and bucking this market and saying I'm selling it at my contract price because I've got new hops waiting from this current crop year, and I don't want to pay storage fees. And so they're listing hops for, you know, Citra, $15 a pound, $14.50, $16.50. I'm going in there and saying this is $11.50, and I've got a lot of it. And everybody's like, whoa, and it's screwing everybody up. And this is going to keep happening. And as this harvest, the harvest is now here. They've pelletized the new crop. And so as soon as I sell my old crop, I can get this new crop that I hand-selected all my hops. And it's like everybody else is doing that too, and it's screwing all these guys that have way over-contracted. And I really think that it's correcting itself. There's not a huge shortage now. And yes, I have a lot of Citra. But yeah, it's correcting itself. The farmers have gotten smart and they've planted a lot more. They see what's going on. They're not stupid. And this is going to last. This is not a fad. It is going to correct itself. They're going to be easier to come by. And that's a darn good thing for all of us that like hoppy beers.
I don't think a brewery will go out of business because they want hops. They won't be hops. I don't think that's going to happen.
So besides cash flow issues when you guys first started up, what was the number one thing you guys underestimated when you started your business?
What was the first part? You said other than capital?
Cash flow issues.
But besides capital, what did you underestimate when you first started?
Capital. We were so undercapitalized, it was pathetic.
I spent
more time trying to find money than actually trying to keep the brewery going, than to actually trying to sell beer. Other than that, the lack of educated beer drinkers in the market and trying to convert them over, I thought it would be a little bit easier.
And the lack of sleep.
Their sleep?
And it's
the lack of sleep.
It's funny how much politics plays into a lot of it. It's you're like, oh, we're gonna open the brewery, the beer's gonna be great, and everybody's gonna love it, and then you got, oh, well, we hired this guy on sales, and no, he used to work on Greenville, and he made a bad reputation, and it's this whole political thing that then comes along with it, and you know, the quality of the beer doesn't matter at that point. It's really frustrating from you know, inside the walls of the production brewery that, you know, they're dealing with this, and we can't get into this bar, or hey, you know, I go to Mellow Mushroom in Fort Worth all the time, and the guy likes it as a power play that my beer is never on draft. it's funny that's one of the things that's just always bugged me, and I've gotten a thick skin about it, but it's just funny how much politics plays into it. And I don't play politics, so I just don't understand it.
I don't play politics either.
It's good. Whoever said that?
Me. In the end, the beer speaks for itself. That's how I look at it.
I'm interested to know, as brewers, and you've been around so long in the game, how much time, because you have these large-scale breweries now, and you have a lot of micromanaging you have to do in other parts of the business, how much do you miss the creation of being able to create more beer more often? How much time do you allow yourself now? And then, when you find something you really like, how do you know that it's the right one to sell?
First of all, my brewers don't let me get anywhere near the brew house anymore. but we're all very much in tune with the creation of new beers. We go through long, tedious steps to make sure that the product that comes out now is exactly the way we want it. We started that with Pride of Texas, and that took us about 6 months of brewing probably 8 to 10 different batches of beer and giving it to the people at our tours and getting their feedback and doing blind tasting panels at the brewery with other beers in the market. And it's very much a creation game amongst the entire team. And when I mean entire team, it could be the distributor or some guy dropping off a package or something, and we're doing the blind tasting and we're having him jump in or her participating in that feedback as well. But for me, yeah, they like to keep me away from anything that I could do to do something bad. So
I actually have a vastly different answer to that question. I am not the owner of Humperdinck's. I'm just the brewer. I've been the brewer for 20 years, and I've never been anything else. I've been fortunate to find someone to pay me to make beer every day for 20 years, and I still love the job. I mean, the job, the boots on, in the, you know, in my chemical guy, it drives him nuts that I still get in and scrub my kettle every brew. He said, you don't need to do that. We've got chemicals that'll clean that just fine. I said, you know, that's just the way I learned. And it goes back to my first brewing job in 1996 was at Humboldt Brewing Company. And the brewmaster was a man named Stephen Parks, an English brewmaster. And I worked there, I apprenticed there for 6 weeks, and I worked there a couple months, and I never saw him with a scrub brush in his hand. And on his last day at work, before he left to teach at the American Brewers Guild, I was up there doing the second brew of the day, and Steve comes running up on the brew house, and he said, you finished knocking out? I said, yeah. He said, I'm getting in the kettle. And I just gave him a look like, what are you talking about? I've never seen you anywhere close to cleaning anything. But it was his last day, and that's to him, that's what the experience was. That's what he wanted to do before he left, was get in the kettle. And that was not an easy kettle. It was a 50-barrel kettle with no ladder. So you had to climb down the calandria, and you know.
Oh, geez. Yeah, hadn't been scrubbed in 2 years.
No, we got it. We did it every brew, and the other two guys I worked with were like tiny little spider monkeys, and then me and Steve were big guys. So it was a struggle to get in and out of there. But that was his last day that he wanted to get in and scrub the kettle. And to me, that's always what it's been about. You know, I admire the guys up here in Wim who have started their own businesses, and you know, I envy the size of everything they've done. But for me, it's the, you know, I just love the job. You know, I just go and do the job every day. And as far as the creativity goes, I don't, you know, we don't field test all that stuff. You know, I've been brewing my seasonal recipes for 20 years, and I've tweaked all of them to where I got them where I love them. And I don't really have to worry about what sells. I'm in a brew pub. They drink what I tell them to drink.
That sounds great. I'm going to do that.
My question is, what can we do as consumers to help the bottlenecks get loosened, that as far as restrictions go, as far as off-premise consumption, like growlers, crowlers, anything restrictive? Because you can go to a winery, drink one glass out of the bottle and take it with you, but you can't do that with a growler. So is there anything that you need us to do as far as writing our representatives, helping these laws get fixed where we can get access to your beer at a much more prevalent level than we have now?
I guess it would be right to representative. That's the only thing I can think.
Jamie, you want to take that? You're on the, on the board.
These guys made me be on the board of representatives, and I told them I would do the technical stuff. Leave me out of legal stuff. They're like, you can't do that. So a cool thing that we're doing in the Texas Craft Brewers Guild is so right now it's kind of like pay to play to be on the legislative committee. Which a lot of people don't agree with, but we're making it a very comprehensive thing where everybody's going to be a part of it. And we can put together an email that tells you all what you need to do. And that's what we will do. We've done that in the past. And there's typically a canned email that we'll put together that you can write your representative, because we don't want you writing them and calling them names and, you know, cursing and all this. But yeah, it is strength in numbers, and it doesn't matter how many canned emails they get. It's like, whoa, you know, look at this response we've gotten about this. And, you know, that is definitely a big help. But it's beneficial for us when it's a concerted effort, and it's within what we've decided as the board. And it's not just, you know, us guys that are on the board. We're talking to all of our, we've been elected to these positions. We you know a lot of people that respect us for one reason or another. My specialties are not legal, so this is a funny question for me, but you know, it is a concerted effort that we put together. And yeah, so that's when that time comes around, we will send an email out, and I don't know the venue of how we get it out to enthusiasts and our fans, but I think that, you know, as breweries, individual breweries, we can get that to you guys, you know, that are signed up for our newsletters. So that's kind of the best thing, is to stay in tune with your favorite local breweries, and we can get you that important information. You know, you follow us on social media and that, we can get you that stuff.
Just look for the bat signal.
Good question, though. Thanks for that.
Great question.
Okay, for those of you that are brewers and those of you that are sellers of beer back 20 years ago, what was the most popular beer? What was your most favorite beer brewed then versus what it is now?
You mean locally in Dallas? Probably the big IPA back in the day was the Hoposaurus. Was that at Two Rows? Was that
Hopzilla?
Hopzilla, that's it. So that was probably as far as IPAs go, that was probably the local standard way back when. For us, it's always been the Texas Blonde, because that's our closest to the big domestic beers, and that's what we just sell the most of. That's still, you know, as much as this explosion has been, there's still, you know, that's still the majority of sales in Texas. And now, I mean, it's hard to pick. I mean, I couldn't pick my favorite beer here right now. There's so many choices. So it's great. It's just been a fabulous bonus for all of us that like good beer.
You know, back at Hopper, I think it would have been my porter. I'd sell out of it instantly. I had a 3.5 barrel system, which is ungodly small. And that's 7 kegs, by the way, and it takes 3 weeks. Yeah. That didn't work out too well. You'd sell out in a week, and it's gone. And then I'd have to tell a little customer, sorry, and about 3 weeks you'll have another batch. So, yeah, that was probably the biggest seller for me back then, and I still like porters. That's probably one of my more favorite beers, especially this time of the year.
For us, it's when we started our wheat beer, and the Dunkel took off immediately, and the numbers are still there. I think in the portfolio we have, we sell in the same percentage pretty much all the beers, but if you want to put a number on it, the Dunkel and the Wheat is still on top of it. I think that has something to do with that we are more the traditional guys. That's what we started off with. All our beers are more sessionable. We do some special releases, or this year we did the World Tour. So they're selling pretty well, because it's something special, what we normally don't do. But the Dunkel and the wheat definitely stands out for us in our portfolio.
Other than our seasonals, it's really kind of funny. Our first two beers we came out with was the Rars Blonde and the Texas Red, and those still today are our two best sellers by quite a margin over everything else. And, you know, we, like Dennis, we're kind of knocked sometimes because people sometimes say we don't do a lot of exciting things, which I kind of disagree with. We make a lot of big beers, just nothing that's like a year-round beer, but we started off with seasonal products, and, you know, I mean, our sessionable products that we have year-round, and those two are still our best-selling products out on the market.
You know, we see, you know, obviously we don't brew, but we work hard to curate a really good list, I think, and offer diversity and, you know, depth within our portfolio. And, you know, you can have a one-off, and it might be a, you know, bourbon barrel-aged stout, and everybody is excited about that. But I think, really, if you look at the numbers, you know, the drinkability of a beer is what's going to sell, you know, and be popular. So I'm surprised sometimes to see that the biggest selling beer, you know, is a blonde ale. And, you know, I mean, just like you just said, you know, that's one of your biggest sellers. And, you know, real ale's their biggest seller, fiber number four. So, you know, I think you brew, you know, big beers for fun, and, you know, you brew sessionable beers for volume.
Okay, we're going to take two more questions. We're going to start wrapping it up. Michael?
Yeah, I think you partially answered the questions, because I heard a lot of things about Wales Hunters, and then your popular beers are still, you know, your more, either it's the first beers you made, like Rar, or the more sessionable ones. And so, I mean, frankly, there's still a lot of big three drinkers out there, right? I mean, we gotta be honest about that. And so the question a little bit is, what can we do from an educational perspective or a promotional perspective, just as people out there drinking beer, to help you guys, if that makes any sense?
Okay, I might get knocked out here by saying that, but I think number one is we gotta stop talking bad about the big threes, because that's what makes them upset, and that's why they get aggressive against what we are doing. So I think that's a big part of it. And, you know, I was laughing when 2 years ago for Super Bowl they came out with that commercial. Everybody was talking about it, and people called me up and asked, hey, what do you think about this commercial? And everybody went hyper about it. Quite honestly, I loved that commercial. I thought it was great that they did it, because at the end, what did they do? They advertised craft beer. That's what they did. So they helped us in a certain movement. And if you look at the sales numbers, the beer volume, the beer sales overall, is actually going down. The craft beer section in that part is going up. But as more as we are pushing into it, I think let us, the craft brewers, do our part on brewing the beer and show that there is better beer out there. But as more we're upsetting them in the front of the house, I think they're getting more and more aggressive, if that makes sense. And I don't know if I...
My take on it is, Mark Cuban just bought this whole area we're in. He gave us the approval to do a beer. The Mavericks facility, practice facility, is in our warehouse. And he said, yeah, you can do a beer and call it Mavericks Lager if it's only on site. So I'm like, sweet. So I brewed a rice lager. It's like an American premium lager. It's about 3.5%. We use Clarity Firm, so it's gluten-free. It's low calorie. It's low alcohol. And it's awesome. Okay, so it's 25% rice, but then I use the most expensive German Pilsner malt you can buy, this heirloom variety Barca Pilsner from Weyermann, and it's freaking awesome. I mean, it's like, you talk crap about these beers that these big guys are making. They're using very cheap ingredients. They are using rice, but then they're using, you know, six-row American barley, which is pretty much flavorless. But on the flip side, we're using flavorful stuff. And I got this inspiration from ABGB, which just brought home Brewery of the Year award from GABF, which is freaking incredible. Goes back to what I was saying about, you know, oh, no breweries in Texas are brewing good beer. They had this Japanese rice lager, they call it, and they called it New American Girlfriend. And that's all I drank when I was GABF. The new American girlfriend. But I mean, it's like it's somebody was saying earlier, you know, it's going away from these big whales. Keith was saying it. It's going away from these huge IPAs, and that's the way in my you know beer drinking you know life I've kind of gone. I like session beers now, and this is a flavorful 3.5% alcohol beer. It's at my brewery. You can bring your buddy that's like, oh, I only like Miller Lite or I like Budweiser. Give them this beer, they're going to be like, all right, I can get down with that. And then you give them, like, you know, the wit beer or, you know, one of our other lighter offerings anybody's got. And, you know, it's a great gateway thing to do. And I think it's a great way to get people into it that are not craft beer drinkers and won't cross the bridge.
You know, that's been our business model, though, the whole time, is to take people off of what they think they want and put them onto something better. And so, you know, my entire career has been that very thing, is to show them something better. And every party that I'm invited to, I'm bringing something that's craft. And I will tell you, they drink that before they drink what they bring. If I just leave it out there. Have you all done that before? Your beer's gone, their beer still there. I even find myself at Whole Foods trying to sell beer on the aisle. I'm like, wait, I don't even work here. But you know, that's what you do. You have to do that. I'm guiding people. No, you don't want that. You want this. And they're like, no, who are you?
Something that was mentioned earlier was the lack of trained personnel for the industry. And Wim mentioned Eastfield locally. I think Wim went to the American Brewers Guild. And I think Jamie might have gone to UC Davis Extension and then the Siebel's Institute in Chicago. I mean, are those recommended places of learning where you would recommend someone to go that was interested in entry in the industry?
I know we had some guy come through that program, I don't know, about a couple, 4 years ago. He was worthless, didn't it? I wouldn't recommend it at all. He opened up some brewery Dallas somewhere. And
he's the worst.
In Garland. I think his name was Wim Benz.
Whatever happened to that guy?
Would never take another person from that organization.
No, I think there's, you know, American Brewers Guild was great for me because I was, I still had a day job, and it allowed remote learning. So I learned all the book stuff off of taped class sessions on DVD for about 6 months. And but that worked for me. And you know, back in my day in 2010. We didn't have a whole lot of choices, and you know the choices are still limited now, but they are. There's a lot more demand, so I think we're starting to see that. But as any academic entity, you want to make sure that if you're going to put a program in place, that it's you know you're putting your name on it. So you want to make sure that it's going to be worth something, and that you're providing a good education in whatever field that you're going to be doing. So I think Eastfield is definitely starting that trend. They do have a good program. I think they're going to expand on that program. UC Davis, obviously still around. Siebel still around. American Brewers Guild still around. And I think there's a lot more colleges and universities across the country, and especially in brewing heavy areas of the country, you know, Pacific Northwest, you know, Asheville, North Carolina. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw something pop up there pretty soon. So I think it's all about supply and demand. And right now the demand is pretty high.
So from the public perception with the threat of being bought out, the public perception is immediately people screaming, you know, distribution, distribution, distribution. From the insider's perspective, how rational is that fear? And if it is a rational fear, what are you doing to combat it? Does it scare you? And then the second part of that is, what are you doing to market yourselves so that you can stay competitive and relevant and everything like that?
I'll jump on the grenade.
It's a good question.
So your question is, if I get it right, you know, once beloved craft brewery is bought out, what does that mean, right? So, you know, we've seen that over with a couple of breweries now here in Texas, and I think that you really kind of have to. For me as a brewery owner, I look at it in two ways. I look at it as, okay, well, here are these guys that I know that have been in the industry for a very long time that have taught me a few things, and that are great people who have made great companies, and they've decided to build a business model in a way that some of us haven't, right? They are either building to sell or they don't mind selling. And that's a business decision. So you can't blame anybody for a business decision, because I'm not, you know, no one's going to tell me how to do my business. I'm not going to tell anybody else how to do their business. From a fan and an emotional perspective, I think people love craft brewing because they can identify it. You're rooting for the underdog. You're emotionally committed to it. You're connected to a brand. And you love it, right? So then when somebody, quote unquote, sells out, you kind of feel let down and you kind of feel betrayed, which I think is, which is okay to feel. Well, I'm gonna jump back up here. I think it's okay to feel that way. And from a, you know, from a competition standpoint, what does that do to us little guys who are not backed by an ABI or Miller Coors? So yeah, so when you're backed by an ABI or backed by a Miller, and they're your owner now, they're going to want to see profits probably in a different way that you would if you were independently owned. They may, you know, they may take your company in a different direction. So you know, it increases competition. They have access to marketing dollars and to raw materials that we don't on a certain level. And it creates more competition. It's going to make it harder on a certain level. So,
if I may jump in here quick, I think what you just said is very interesting. We have to make a difference here, which when we signed with one of the big distributors, people were talking or thought we sold out. Which, if you sign up with a distributor and they're the house of Miller or Budweiser or whoever, that doesn't mean that we as a craft brewery sold out, or that we still work independently. They just bring our beer from point A to point B. So I think that it's a lot different as if somebody really gets the dollars from that brewery. So we don't have those dollars in the background they have now, where they can do advertising, marketing, and things like that. So we pretty much pay them to bring our beer from point A to point B, and we are still independent. So it definitely creates some different competition here if a brewery sells out. They were independent at that point because the distributors, and if it's the same house you're with, you're for sure concerned, because you don't know what are they going to do now with their portfolio on your side and on their side.
Yeah, I would say I get the question a lot. It's like, oh, you sold out to Benny Keith. And it's like, no. I think it's a common misconception. It's like, no, I don't want to be in the distribution business. If brewing is an economy of scale, distribution is definitely an economy of scale. And some of the smaller distributors that have started up, I mean, we are with Benny Keith, and we talked to them, and we're like, man, it's going to be really tough. I mean, we know how thin our margins are. It's just got to be so tough, and it's just a matter of time before they close the doors, it seems like. And I hope that's not the case. I hope these smaller guys can make it work, but by no means is it us selling out. I'm sick of maintaining trucks or having delivery drivers, and you know, you sign with these big distributors, they have all these resources at their disposal. They have drivers, they have a fleet of trucks, they can logo their trucks. They're professional distributors, and I'm a professional brewer. I didn't sign up. I maintain lauter tons and motors. I don't want to have to maintain all my fleet of trucks. And you know, geez, Revolver did it for so long. What'd they have, like 30 trucks? I mean, anywhere you're driving around, you'd see a Revolver truck. I know we've all seen them because there's a freaking lot of them. But it was the bane of their existence. I know Grant really well, and those guys would just. They would never stop talking about how what a pain in the ass it was to distribute their own beer, but they did it, and they did it well. So, but that's why we sign with distributors. And it's funny, in the last, I'd say, 2 years, it's become like, oh, you know, they sign with Benny Keith, but like like Dennis said, it's like this used to be looked at like it was an evil thing, and how quickly that's changed, because it really is necessary, especially in this this growing market. So we need all the edge we can get.
We have, I mean, I'm not even shy to share some numbers here and what actually is involved here. What a lot of people don't know, we signed up with Benny Keith as well. Soon we knew that we got to go into bottling. Draft beer distribution is still manageable on a self-distribution base. Soon you go into bottles and you have to deal with those big retailers. What a lot of people don't know, that beer that's in that shelf, that is put in that shelf by the brewery or the distributor. The people in the grocery store, they're actually getting money to work in there. They do not fill those shelves. So it's the brewery or it's a distributor who does it. And like Jamie said, do we really want to pay people to go in there from store to store? I mean, if you're in 100, 150, 200 grocery stores, you need probably 20 people they drive every day from store to store to put a six pack in there, because nobody who works at that store is going to do it. So we pay those distributors, and we pay them in the way that we have to give our beer to a certain price. And I mean, I probably shouldn't do that, but we're talking about 30-40% we have to take off that price to have the distributor to do that for us. So it's a lot of money that's we are, as the brewers, actually losing, which, well, those bottles.
We're not spending on truck maintenance.
Yes, not spending on truck
or insurance.
And other things.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Well, I think that's going to about wrap it up for tonight. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Let's give a big hand to the panel. Thank you, everybody, for coming out. If you can, stick around, have a beer. Tap room's open. You guys come on and come mingle with us for a while. And we'll see you here next time.